Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Here's the wonderful thing about, there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Here's the wonderful thing about Holden. 6 months ago, I think, when Sharon sent out the forms asking, what are you going to talk about? I diligently filled them out right away and shot them back to her. And then 2 weeks ago, I thought, everything's changing. There are new things that are going on with a piece of my mind, and I sent her a note. I'm like, how late? It's too late to completely throw away everything and start over. She's like, go for it. So this is a reworked version of what we were going to do. And then even last night, as I was listening to Joe and David, and even this morning as I was listening to Glenn, I was making notes and changing it again. So I think there's kind of a beauty in that sort of spontaneity and playing off of one another. And I'm really fascinated with the different programming that's going on and how it all sort of resonates. And so as I was, who was in Glenn's morning session on Jericho? Yeah. So listening to that story of the walls coming down in Jericho, I had an image in my mind, and we don't know because of the text, but in my mind, I'm imagining that as the people inside saw other people approaching the city, that they sealed the doors, that they closed it off, and that it never happened that somebody engaged with the other. That nobody ever came out to approach the other folks and say, hey, how you doing? What's going on? What do you need? Is there something we can do together here? They just isolated themselves. And yes, that's defensiveness, that's protection, but it's also lost opportunity in how we can connect with other people around us. And so for me, that resonates really well with what we try to do with this project, a piece of my mind. And then the other thing that I thought was really interesting, last night with Joe and David, who was in the room for that. Okay, this notion of salwa bona, which is to say, I think it's an East African word, which is to say, I see you and I hear you, and you have worth, you have value. That's something I say really often during this process. In fact, I want to share a story with you. This book that we produced, I self-published it. We did have one offer from a publisher who was a faith-based publisher, which is great because I'm a faith-based person, but they're more conservative than I am. And so they said, we'd love to publish your book if you would just remove the voices of the gay and the lesbian people. And I said, so you want me to take a project which is rooted in the notion of listening to people, no matter who they are, whether you agree with them or not, and then you want me to take the voices you disagree with and remove them? And they said, yeah. And I said, no. So we ran a crowdfunding campaign and published it ourselves so we could do it the right way. And that was a really easy choice. It was kind of a no-brainer. But the day after the book release party, I was talking to some fifth graders, and a little girl raised her hand, and she said, have you ever talked to someone who's from a family with a mom and a dad, but they're the same thing? And I had to scratch my head for a second and go, do you mean a gay or a lesbian couple? And she said, yeah. And I said, yeah, absolutely. Second story in the book, Laura Patey. Been married to her partner for 30-some years. They adopted a couple kids out of the foster care system and raised them as their own. I said, absolutely, that's a part of this collection. And she said, okay, thanks. And she paused and she said, because I have two moms. And I thought, what would it have been like if I had to say, well, sure, we've interviewed people like that, but we don't include them in the book. You know, I think that notion of salwa bona, that ability to say to somebody, I hear you and I see you and you have worth, is one of the most powerful things that we can do for one another, to acknowledge one another and to be with one another. So the project is, I'll talk more about it. Who has been in one of my sessions before? There's a few familiar folks. Okay, I'll ask for your patience a little bit as we share sort of the background of the project. because I think it really lays the foundation for what we hope we can do communally later on in the week. So maybe I'll just start with that. And I'll tell you that this is a multimedia arts project that I started 10 years ago, and it's now become my life's work. You know, this was a side little hobby thing, and it's now all that I do. And I was, it's based around this simple question: what does peace mean to you? And, look, I'm out of order already. That's okay. That's familiar. Here we go. So I brought the project down to Memphis, Tennessee, not long ago, and had the chance to speak at the National Civil Rights Museum, which is in the Lorraine Motel, where Dr. King was assassinated 51 years ago now. And I was reminded of his notion of beloved community. You know, which is this notion that we could mature to see beyond prejudice and discrimination, that we could, our circles of compassion could expand to include all people. And I think you don't have to look very far to realize that we've fallen short of that mark. You know, you turn on the television, you open up the newspaper, and you realize in all sorts of ways we've failed to live up to that ideal. But for me, when things feel particularly frustrating, when it seems like the problems of today are bigger than the solutions we can bring to the table, I think it's also important to acknowledge what is right, what is good in the world. So I've worked for my entire career as a freelance photographer, and I shoot for national magazines and Fortune 500 companies. I've had the good luck to shoot travel assignments across the United States and around the world. And I've come to realize over the years that it's my job to find beauty in unexpected places. You know, the people hire me to find good where other people might struggle to see it. And that doesn't mean that we ignore the challenges of the day. You know, the world is filled with challenges, and I think it's important that we address those honestly and directly. But it's also important that we face those challenges with a grace and a hope and the belief that something better is possible. You know, as a freelance photographer, you're always making choices about the projects you'll accept. Does it square up with my worldview? Does it support ideas I believe in? And does it justify being away from my family for a certain length of time? And at our house, we've embraced the saying that you probably know, which is some jobs feed the belly, and some jobs what?
Feed the soul.
Feed the soul. Yeah, when you're really lucky, your job can do both. And so, back about 10 years ago, I found there were two things going on in my life. And the first is that my soul was getting hungry. You know, I was frustrated with the quality of our national dialogue. That was 10 years ago. I'm not sure we're doing better now. But so I wondered, instead of the divisive conversations that we were having in the world, I wondered if there was a way to use my photography and storytelling instead to look at what connects us, to sort of rediscover that common humanity. So that was the first thing going on. The second thing happening about the same time is, I like to say, the economy handed me some free time, if you know what I mean. The recession hit the world of freelance photography really hard, and my workload dropped quickly and dramatically. And if I was a better business person, I would have used that time to look for new clients. But like I said, my soul was getting hungry. And so this is how I decided to feed it. And I started playing around with this idea of peace that was taken right here a couple years ago. In fact, this is the one photo in the whole project I didn't take. My daughter Brenna took it with my wife Karen's cell phone. You know, this notion of peace is something that I think most people I've encountered would welcome a little bit more of in their lives, whether it's in their immediate family or the bigger world. Even my friends that serve in the US military, I think, would prefer to stay home with their families when they could. But here's the thing about peace. We say we want it, but we're not very good at getting it. We're not very good at making it. And so you might have high school students who'll flash the peace sign when they walk down the hall and frame up their selfies, and then they'll turn and form into cliques and bully their own classmates. You'll have a peace activist who holds a sign that says, give peace a chance, but they can't get along with their immediate family members. You know, at my church, about 1,500 miles that way, called Peace Lutheran Church, ironically. You'll have people who nod up and down on Sunday morning while they listen to the story of the Good Samaritan. You know, a story about helping somebody in need, no matter who it is, and then Monday they'll walk right by somebody in need like it's not their problem. You know, so that's not a critique of my church, that's a critique of the human condition, because it happens all the time. There's a disconnect between what we say we value and how we live our day-to-day lives. And so I started playing with this question, what does peace mean to you? And on the surface, that's a pretty simple question, but it really quickly gets at the core of who we are as human beings. What we value as a society. It opens the door to all sorts of interesting conversations about race and gender, about national policy, international priorities. And once we established the question, the process was remarkably simple. We just listened. That's it. You know, we listen in our day-to-day lives in order to debate or debunk, we'll listen to correct, coerce, or convince somebody to think the same way we do, but the act of listening just to understand, I think, can be rare. And imagine how the world could shift if we could do a little bit more of that. So when I started listening, I started hearing stories from people like Jarrell Wilson, who started his interview by saying, I'm black, gay, Christian, and I live in Texas. He said, by all means, you think I might be miserable, but in fact, I see beauty everywhere. And I heard from Penina Bowman in Atlanta, Georgia. And Penina tells a story about growing up as a young girl in World War II Europe. And she said one day, soldiers knocked on their door and they said, you've got 10 minutes to pack your things and then you got to go. And they didn't know where they were going, but they wound up going to Auschwitz. And so both of Penina's parents and 42 members of her family died at Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how difficult it was to even hold on to a little bit of hope in a setting like that. But she said also that she made a choice not to hate. She said, because hate is a really powerful tool and it's intended to destroy somebody else, but in fact it circles back and it destroys you instead. Hello. Who else do we have? Oh, yeah, and Dan Gallagher out north of Missoula, Montana. And Dan's a Vietnam War vet. I used to imagine if I'd been born maybe 10 years earlier that I would have been out on the protest lines during the Vietnam War. And I always sort of admired those protesters as I was growing up. Dan helped me understand some of the damage that they did in the process. And so Dan talks about, he joined the service to help his country. He went and he did his time, and when he came back from Vietnam, all he wanted to do was get back to his life. You know, go to college, maybe get married, buy a house, and keep moving forward. He said he was so derailed by the anger he was met with. You know, he was getting off the bus and a young woman was carrying a sign that called him a baby killer, and she spit on him when he got off the bus. And he said it took him years to recover from that sort of mental whiplash that he had when he got back. And Dan said, you know, we never really had the chance to talk peace with the peace people because everybody was too busy yelling at one another. So eventually this project took me on a 40,000 mile road trip across the country. Took a few years, and we did it in about 9 different trips. But meeting people from different backgrounds, asking them these questions, what does peace mean to you? How do you work towards it in your life? And the project took me places that I never knew existed. I got to go to Nicodemus, Kansas to meet Angela Bates. And Nicodemus was settled by freed slaves after the Civil War. Used to be a lot of towns like this west of the Mississippi. As far as I know, Nicodemus is the only one that still exists. Angela says that she comes from a long line of people with great determination and faith in God and perseverance. And she said she was really proud of this heritage. In fact, everybody in town was proud of the heritage, so they decided to talk to the National Park Service and see if there was something they could do to honor it. And here's where we get a little tone deaf, I think, as a society. Because after about 20 years, the Park Service said, yeah, you're right, we can do that. We'll honor that place that was settled by freed slaves, and they built this beautiful museum, and they staffed it with all white people. You know, it doesn't make any sense. But there's a lot of things that don't make sense. And Angela talked about how frustrating this process was, but she also said that she realized that she had a choice about how she was going to respond to the world around her. And I think that we all have that choice. You know, we can't always control what happens to us, but we can absolutely control the way we respond to it. And so Angela got together with some other people, and they decided that they wanted to tell their own story. So they also opened up their own museum, the Nicodemus Historical Society, so that they could tell their story, because for Angela, we aren't going to know where we're headed unless we also know where we've been. There's a little whimsy in the project as well. I got to the end of the interview and I said, Angela, what do you think the chances are that we could get the whole town together for a portrait? And she said, well, I'll start making calls. She said, you'll probably get everybody except for my dad because he's kind of crabby. She said, but in fact, there he is too, right up there. So that is the whole town of Nicodemus, Kansas, 16 souls farming wheat and milo on the Kansas prairie, and one chihuahua. So I got to go places that I didn't know existed. I got to go places that that I had always heard about or always wanted to go. You all have seen the movie Forrest Gump? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the shrimp boats that have the little nets hanging? I'm a visual person, so I'm kind of driven by what I think would be interesting to photograph. So I thought it'd be really great to be able to photograph those shrimp boats. So I made a series of about 3 phone calls, which led me to Kenny Terrio, who's a third generation Cajun shrimper down in Chauvin, Louisiana. And I asked Kenny what it was like to be a shrimper, and he said, well, you go out there and you find shrimp and then you catch them.
If they're there.
What?
If they're there.
If they're there, yes.
Which is not always.
Not always the case, right. Well, so I wondered to myself a little bit, I ask myself all the time, if I'm trying to talk about peace, why am I talking to a shrimp fisherman? But he went on to talk about community, and he said, you know, when we were shrimping, we all worked together. And one person would build a boat and we'd help him, and then the next one would build a boat and we'd help him, and then pretty much everybody had a boat at the end, so that worked out pretty good. So this notion to me of making sure everybody around you has the resources that you need, making sure everybody has the tools required to be able to thrive in the world, and supporting one another like that is absolutely tied into my notion and understanding of peace. So we got to the end of the interview, and Kenny said, where are you staying tonight? And I said, I have no idea, what do you suggest? Because I'm always hopeful and I'm always cheap. And he said, well, I have a burnt out RV in the backyard if you want to sleep there. I said, that sounds good. And he said, in the morning, we'll go out looking for alligators. And I said, that sounds good. And he said, if you can stay one more day, shrimping season starts and you can come out on the golf with me. And I said, that sounds real good. So we went out so I got to not only see the boats, I got to ride on the boats, and went out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and came back at 8 o'clock in the morning and found 1,200 pounds of shrimp in the meantime. And I haven't eaten shrimp since. But I never ate shrimp before, so it wasn't a great sacrifice. When I do these interviews, when I do these projects, I don't try to pretend to be someone that I'm not. So. I promise you, Kenny figured out pretty quick that I'm a bit of a tree hugger, and I promise you, Kenny is not. You know, and so we could have had some pretty difficult conversations. We could have pretty quickly shut each other down, but when you are on somebody else's boat who's taking care of you, there's a good reason to be friendly. Mm-hmm. And you know, we through the course of our conversations, we found a lot of common ground. Even if we probably voted for different people in the last election cycle, even if we approached the world in really different ways, you know, it turns out a shrimp fisherman is dependent on the weather. It turns out they may catch some one time and they won't catch some another time. Turns out a travel photographer is pretty dependent on the weather. Some days you have a job, some days you don't have a job. And so we found a lot of common ground that we could explore, even as we knew there was difference as well. So in this process, what's interesting to me is that I've done hundreds of these interviews now. I've done thousands of these shorter form stories, and people have asked me along the way what I've learned, like what's your conclusion about peace? And at first, that was a really hard question to answer, but eventually there were some themes that came up, and I want to share a few of those with you now. Oops, first I'll tell you this. Eventually I realized that there was some power in these stories, and we decided to share them sort of as broadly as we could. And so we gathered the stories into books. We gathered the stories into exhibits that we bring around the country, not to tell people the secret meaning of peace, but to invite people to be a part of the conversation, sort of to acknowledge that if there are challenges in the world, that these are our challenges to address, and if there are going to be solutions in the world, that those solutions are most likely going to come from us. And then we've also invited people to share their stories, and I'll talk about this more a little bit later, about the studio sessions that we're going to do later in the week. Hang on a second. Where the heck am I? Okay. So there are a few themes that have bubbled up, and I want to share a couple of those with you now. And these themes are specific to the individuals who shared the story, but I also think that they're universal to how we can find ways to work better together. So the first lesson is to listen to difficult realities. And as I travel, I tend to have most of these interviews, these long-form interviews, lined up before I leave home. I want to make sure that I'm productive. But the day before I got to Alabama on my southern loop, my interview fell apart. Person wasn't available, they weren't feeling well. And so I just threw it out to social media. I said, does anybody know anybody I can talk to in Alabama? Which is pretty broad net. But at that point, I just wanted to trust the process and believe that something would happen. And so two different people from different parts of my life said, well, you ought to find this woman named Joanne Bland and talk to her. And so I Googled her name, I found her number, and I called her up and explained the project. And I said, what are the chances you have 5 hours free tomorrow? And she said, come on over. So actually, first she said, let me look at your website and really understand what this is. Call me back in an hour. And when I called her back, she said, yeah, come on over. And so Joanne Bland marched with Dr. King from Selma to Montgomery when she was 11 years old. I sat in her living room with her 12 days after Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. So I promise you that there were some really difficult moments in that conversation. You know, not because of anything Joanne did. You know, she was a gracious host, but because of the dynamics of what's happening in our country. Because here I am, a middle-aged white guy from up north, coming down and sitting with a civil rights icon in her living room, and she's frustrated, and she's wounded, and she's angry that we haven't yet finished the work that she started when she was 11 years old. You know, that we've not yet gotten where we need to be as a nation. And Joanne says, she said, you know, if I was a child, we might have a fist fight this morning and we'd be playing by noon. You know, we're still buddy-buddy. But adults, we hold on to our craziness. We hold on to stupidity. So you got a wall that you can throw up, and I got a wall that I can throw up that wasn't there when we were kids. You know, we just shared what children share, the sense of peace and freedom to play, to love, and to just be happy. But what happens as we grow up is life. And sometimes that makes us better, but sometimes it makes us worse. And she said, one day we'll be all right, but I'm tired of waiting for one day. I want it to be now. I want it to be in my lifetime. She said, when I was marching with Dr. King, I thought by now we'd have that beloved community he talked about, but it hasn't happened yet. You know, and I think as a nation, as individuals, we've got a lot of work to do. Yeah, and if we're going to be able to do that work, we're going to have to be willing to sit with some uncomfortable realities. I think I'll speak for myself, but maybe for others in the room too, our initial reaction becomes defensive when we have some of these conversations. We have to be able to set that defensiveness aside and sit with those stories if we're going to be able to move forward. Lesson two, look for solutions. This is John George, who I met in Detroit, Michigan. And I knew that Detroit struggled, but I'd never been there myself. And when I sat down with George, he said, you know, when the nation gets the cold, Detroit gets the flu. And he said, about now, we're suffering from double pneumonia. And John told the story of growing up next to a crack house. And he had a young child at home. He had another one on the way. And he didn't want them to grow up in that situation. So he thought about moving. He didn't want to move. He thought about, he did everything he could to change the situation. He called the police department, he called the city hall, but nobody would or could do anything about it. So John thought, okay, this is my home. You know, I pay my taxes, I take out the garbage, I mow my lawn, I don't want to go anywhere. So instead he went to the hardware store and he picked up plywood, nails, and paint. And he came back and he boarded up the crack house. And when the drug dealers came back, they couldn't get in, so they kept going. You know, so that worked out pretty good for him, and he could have stopped right there. But instead, he took that little spark and he fanned it into a flame. And he started talking to his other neighbors and said, hey, you know, maybe we can do this, and maybe we can do that. Now he runs an organization with 10,000 volunteers a year called Motor City Blightbusters, and they'll tear down abandoned buildings. They'll replace them with public gardens and public orchards, and they take what used to be a liability in the community and they flipped it to an asset. Mm-hmm. And John says that we're out to change the world and we're starting in Detroit, which I think is a pretty bold statement, mm-hmm. but I also think he might be able to do it. But he also says we all know what the problems are, and there are many, but to continue to focus on the problems and not also look for a solution is our mistake. Couple more. Lesson three, stay at the table. Didn't you just say stay in the room? Yeah. So this is Maham Khan, who I met at Harper College in Palatine, Illinois. And Maham Khan is Muslim. She didn't talk much about her faith. It was a pretty private thing for her. But when she started school, she knew she wanted to get involved in an organization. She wanted to meet new people. She wanted to broaden her resume. And so she decided to join the Muslim Student Association. And she went to the first meeting, and somehow she got elected as the president. So be careful at meetings. And Maham was a little uncomfortable with that. This was a little outside of her comfort zone. But she said, you know what, I can do this. We'll study Quranic verses on Tuesday. We'll have a little pizza on Thursday. How hard could it be? What could possibly go wrong? Well, a couple weeks later, 9/11 happened. And all of a sudden, she was way outside of her comfort zone. You know, when we're that uncomfortable, we usually do one of two things. We either run away or we face it head on. And that's what Maham decided to do. So she started organizing interfaith dialogue sessions on campus. She realized really quickly that when people walked by each other in the hallways and they mumbled things under their breath, that this actually raised tension on campus. But when they sat down together and had a conversation, when they got to know one another's names, when they got to start to build a relationship, that this actually reduced tensions. And she said this worked at her campus because people were willing to stay at the table. You know, when we continue to be engaged with people, when we find conflict, and we always will, but when we're engaged, there's some hope that we can resolve that conflict, that we can find a way forward. When we walk away from the table, the hope walks away with us. And so I guess my question for you here today is, when things get difficult, will you stay at the table? Two more. Try again. This is Hassan Iksan Salim, who I think may be the only Maldivian cowboy in the world. He's the only one that I know. Maldives is an island nation off the coast of India, lowest lying nation on Earth, average elevation of 4 feet above sea level. So as climate change does what climate change is going to do, the Maldives will be one of the first places affected. Hassan had never seen a horse in his life, but he had this weird love for John Wayne movies and Louis L'Amour novels. So every year his dad would give him a toy horse for his birthday, and every year it'd get a little bit bigger. Eventually Hassan came over to the United States on an exchange program, lived with a family that lived on a ranch, and he got to see a horse, he got to learn how to ride a horse, and he got to learn how to train them in the vaquero style. Whoops. Does anybody know what the vaquero style of training is? It's a Spanish style of training. with no strict deadlines. So your horse might learn something one day and forget it the next, and then learn it again and forget it again. It's kind of like raising kids, I think. I don't know why I looked right at you, sorry. But eventually, it turns out a really, really good horse, right? And again, I ask myself, why am I talking to this Maldivian cowboy when I'm trying to talk about peace? But Hassan said, even with horses, people say, oh, you've been working with this horse for 6 months and he still sucks. His words, not mine. And I say, well, I'm going to keep on trying. And one day that horse will be great, and I'll ride him in the biggest rodeo, and I'll take him up in the high country and pull a steer, and it'll be the most beautiful thing in the world. He said, and that's the goal. He said, one day there will be peace. And maybe I'll not live to see it, and maybe my kids won't live to see it, but we'll know that we tried. We'll know that we did everything we could. And that's why we try again and again. And lesson is forgive. So, as I was bringing my exhibit out to New York University a few years back, we were driving right by Newtown, Connecticut, and the shooting had just happened at Sandy Hook. And so, as we went by the exit, there were little candles burning in the snow and flags for each of the victims, and it got really quiet in the car. And I knew I wanted to talk to somebody who was touched by public violence, right? My goal was to try to personify some of the social issues that we're dealing with as a country. So I wanted to talk to somebody who'd been touched by public violence, but I also didn't want it to be Sandy Hook because it felt too new. It felt like the families were getting beat up by being pulled out by the media for little sound bites, and the whole thing was just too recent. So when I was going through Oklahoma City, later that year, I was able to connect with Bud Welch. And Bud had one daughter, Julie Marie, who had graduated from Marquette University in Milwaukee. I'm trying to remember the year. Wait a second. Yeah, she graduated in 1995. So Julie Marie was fluent in 5 languages. She was offered a job with the Social Security Administration as a translator in the federal building in Oklahoma City, and 4 months later, Timothy McVeigh blew it up. And so Julie Marie and 185 other people died that day, and Bud fell apart. You know, of course he did. He became an alcoholic. He lost his businesses. He really wanted nothing more than for Timothy McVeigh to be executed. Just get him off the face of the earth and let me try to go on living my life. Until he saw a news clip of Timothy McVeigh's father on TV. And Bud said, that guy, he looks as wrecked as I am. And he realized that he wanted to meet Timothy McVeigh's dad. And it took him about 3 years to find the courage and to find the way to do that. But eventually he sat at the McVeigh family table in the kitchen with Bill McVeigh. All the family pictures hanging on the wall, including Timothy, looking down at him, and Bud said that that was the day he realized he didn't want Tim to die. And so he started working against the execution of Timothy McVeigh. He didn't succeed. You know, McVeigh was executed pretty quickly in the big picture. But now Bud goes around the world working against capital punishment, having realized that he got no sense of peace. He got no sense of relief from the loss of one more life. And Bud said, before Tim's execution, I started feeling like I was forgiving him. Now, that's a process, and it takes time. I don't know how to teach it, but I do know that I went through it. And I can tell you one thing. Forgiveness doesn't do a damn thing for the killer, but you totally free yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's where the good comes from. Does that look familiar? So, Charlottesville shooting, was that 2 years ago? I think? Yeah, I think
yes,
so.
It was 2 years.
So when we were here, you know, Holden is this great little bubble and you can leave the world behind, but of course some news leaks in. And when we were here, the white supremacists marched in Charlottesville. yeah, it wasn't the shooting, it was the car. And then somebody drove a car into the crowd for the counter protesters and killed Heather Heyer. Yeah. Also, while we were here at our hometown in Bloomington, Minnesota, somebody threw a bomb at a mosque. Same mosque where our friends Noor and Ward pray every day. And so while we were here, it felt a little difficult to know how to respond to that as we're here in the wilderness and these things are sort of raging down the mountain. And so we just decided to gather like this and hold candles and commit to take them down the mountain into a world of darkness that desperately needs it. Let me pause there for a second. Let me just add that for me, each of the stories in this project is a point of light. Each of these stories is an example of how we can live better together. Dr. King left us with a lot of good words, but one of my favorite sayings is, which you're also familiar with, I'm sure, is that hatred can't drive out hatred. Only what?
Love
can do that. And darkness can't drive out darkness. Only what?
Light
can do that. And as I work on this project, as I encounter these people, I'm more and more convinced every day that you and I are that love, and that you and I are that light, and that we've got a lot of work to do in the world. Let me pause there for a second and ask if there are questions about this project. If there's something I can answer, I'm going to back this up a little bit while you think about that. As a trained interviewer, I'll sit in silence for long periods of time waiting for you to talk.
I have a question. In your book, it looks like there's about a page for each person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you condensed out of your 5-hour interview.
Yeah, the interview itself is between 1 and 2 hours, depending on how much the person has to say. It's a recorded interview. It takes about an hour for me usually to figure out the portrait and set up for that. And then the other couple of hours, we started shooting some video as well. And so that's the other couple hours if it happens. So yes, we've condensed, you know, a 5,000 word transcript down into 250 or 300 words for this, but also these interviews live online. So you can go there and you can hear a 20-minute or a 30-minute excerpt from the interview and get more background on the person. You'd think I would have cards with me, but I will tomorrow. So this is a small portion of that.
Hey, John?
Yeah.
I'm wondering how all these amazing people that you've talked about, how you may have changed personally. Mm. As a result of your encounters with them over time.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you that, I'll use an example. When we were starting this project, when we were slowly going broke, there was one point where my wise wife said, you know, we should sell this big gas guzzling truck as gas prices are going up to $5 a gallon to free up a little bit of economic pressure so you can keep doing this. And right about then, I had the chance to interview an oil company executive who was like number two in Royal Dutch Shell. So in a very real way, I went into the interview thinking, man, here's this guy making money hand over fist, and I can't even keep gas in my car. And I promise you, I had a certain expectation of what an oil company executive was going to be. And it wasn't a positive image I had in my mind. But when I sat down and talked to him, sort of when I took the time to hear his story, it gave me a chance to recognize some humanity in him, to see a more complex picture of him than I was willing to begin with. And so I think in this process for me, I've been able to recognize some of my own biases. You know, Joe and I, as we rode up here, talked a little bit about this and those biases. We all have them, and they're really easy to see in somebody else, but they're a little harder to recognize in yourself. And so part of this process for me has been to challenge my own biases. You know, I will go intentionally out of my comfort zone to engage with somebody who's had an experience that's wholly unfamiliar to me, more than anything, to see if I could learn a little bit. You know, to engage with someone who's been through the prison system, and we'll talk more about that in the next session, to engage with somebody who's been homeless, to engage with somebody from different faith traditions. I mean, the audience is really threefold. First audience is me, so that I can learn through firsthand experience. Second audience is the people that I'm talking to say to them, I hear you, and I see you, and you have worth. And the third audience is this, to bring different experiences and different perspectives to help other people consider other possibilities. So I think my biggest lesson has been challenging my own biases and I think patience with the process. You know, because we all understand how the world ought to change, but those changes can take a long time. And people are at all different places with these conversations, and so I think I've found more patience than I had before with that process and that timeline to develop that new understanding. Yeah.
Can you talk about how you see the relationship between peace and justice? So, you know, people talk about there can be no peace without justice, and
right. Sort
of that systemic analysis. And so Timothy McVeigh, God bless him, his dad had this metanoia experience, and yet, like, the system still executed his son. So, like, how do you nuance that in your own mind?
Yeah. I think for me, so the least interesting conversation about peace is sort of the Pollyannish, you know, kumbaya, everybody get along conversation. The most interesting conversation for me is to acknowledge those places of tension, to find those intersections where things are really difficult and conflict builds, and to find a way forward from that. To look at that and say, okay, are we going to turn towards more conflict, or are we going to turn towards resolution? And so for me, that's the most interesting conversation. And when I think about peace, my definition is a communal definition, which means that I don't have a full sense of peace in my own life if I know that the people around me do not also have that peace. And you know, that's directly connected to justice. You know, I think the notion of peace and justice, that everybody has the tools they need in order to thrive, that everybody has, you know, the opportunity to succeed. And when that doesn't happen, and when there isn't peace, you know, I always fall squarely on the side of nonviolence, but sometimes that process towards justice and peace can be bumpy, and I have patience with that. You know, when I think about the civil rights movement, when I think about Dr. King and the access that he had to power and the access that he had to leadership and having conversations about how things could change, I'm not sure that Dr. King would have had that access if it wasn't also for Malcolm X in the picture, mm-hmm. who maybe the establishment was less willing to work with, since Malcolm X was sort of rattling things a little bit louder than Dr. King, but Malcolm X helped create the pressure that would allow the establishment to sit down with Dr. King. I think of the same thing in the environmental movement. You know, the establishment is a little less comfortable with Greenpeace because they're out there really making waves and making some loud headlines, but that's putting pressure on the establishment to maybe sit down with somebody like the Sierra Club, who they view as more reasonable. And so that's how that change happens. And so when I look at that process of peace and justice, there are different ways of getting there, and there are different voices and different styles. You know, some people are really comfortable out on the street with a protest sign. Other people are more comfortable talking in a church setting. Other people are more comfortable writing to a legislator. Those are all parts of the process. It's not this is the right way to make the change or that's the right way to make the change. It takes all of these things together, I think. And right now I'm thinking that was a pretty long answer, and did it actually answer your question?
No, it didn't. Yeah.
It did, okay.
I mean, it's helpful. Like the body of Christ idea that like you're doing your ear thing, and hopefully there are noses out there doing the nose thing.
Right.
And we're all working for it. But you're maybe not called to be a Capitol Hill. You're called to do your own thing and trust that you can't do everything. And so.
Yeah, and I think because people are people, sometimes that leads to conflict too. You ought to be out there. You ought to be more vocal. You ought to be doing it this way. But I think that there's a lot of ways to serve. There's a lot of ways to move in that direction. Yeah.
It's kind of on a similar subject, but how do you, I guess you personally, deal with the balance between just the listening with no agenda, mm-hmm. but also being able to call someone out? I guess, like, for me, part of justice is also being able to, hopefully gently and compassionately, but call someone out when, you know, they are doing something that works against this peace and this justice.
Yeah. In the interviews, when I sit down with people, I let them know at the beginning that I'm going to ask hard questions. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, I'm not always going to disagree, or I'm not always going to agree with you. And if I hear something that I think doesn't square up with my understanding of the world, we're going to talk about that. I give you space to talk about it, but I'm also going to take space to, I don't know if I refute it necessarily, but I squarely share how I see it. You know, and I try to do that in a gentle way. That doesn't attack. I try to do that in a gentle way that allows people the space, you know, and then we move on. You know, one of the mistakes I think we make, two of the mistakes I think we make often in these conversations is that we think we have to resolve it. You know, I'm not going to stop picking at this scab until you agree that my point is right. You know, sometimes you have to just say okay and you move on to other things. The other thing I think we make the mistake of is that we don't do the early work for the conversation, that we launch right into the difficult conversation, we step right into the middle of the fire, and then we're surprised when we get burned. You know, I think it's really important that when we're going to enter these conversations, whether it's about race, whether it's about faith, whether it's about gender, whatever it is, that we first do the hard work of laying a foundation, of taking time to hear the person and acknowledge them before we start into that difficult thing. So when I start my interviews, I always start, you know, tell me your name, where are we sitting today? They talk a little bit. My next question is always, if I didn't know anything about you, what do you want me to know? You know, I want to hear your view of you. And giving people that platform and starting that conversation, and then in the process making myself vulnerable as well. Because if I'm going to expect that person to be vulnerable and honest with me, I'm going to have to be vulnerable and honest with them. And so that's part of that process. But I absolutely will challenge. More than challenge, I think the right thing would be to ask for clarity. You know, and so two of my favorite questions are, what do you mean by that? And tell me more. You know, you just said something that sounds surprising to me. Tell me more. You know, as opposed to going, oh, no. That's not how I see it. You know, tell me more. Help me understand that. Where did that come from? What were the experiences in your life that got you there? And to spend more time doing that before I even respond at all, I think.
Joe and I call that slight amount.
Slight amount.
Yeah, where you, there's a way to kind of redirect or question in kind of Aikido, you know, rather than just, you're wrong what you said, but
right.
A way to call somebody
with
creative, you know, prophetic imagination.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't know.
No, I love that. Let me tell you one more thing, and then we'll come back to this question. Tyrone Wirtz spent 36 years in prison for second-degree murder. His sentence was commuted, and then he was released about a year before I sat down and talked to him. And when we did the interview, we did it at Temple University, where he worked with youth. There's this project called, it's going to elude me right now, It was started at Temple, now it's rippled out across the country. Tyrone was instrumental in starting it. It's a class, a college class on prison reform. And half of the attendees, they hold the class at the prison. And half of the attendees are college students and half of the attendees are inmates. And so they get a chance to have this really fascinating conversation with these people from two vastly different experiences. And the students learn a lot. The inmates learn a lot in the process. But when I interviewed him, it was in this dumpy little office at Temple University. And we got to the end of the interview and I said, Tyrone, we can't make an interesting photo here. There's nothing to work with. And we talked about it and thought about it for a little while. And I said, well, hear me out. I said, I'm a visual person. And I said, visually, here you are looking like your reformed self, right? You're wearing a suit and tie, you look sharp. I said, I think it would be a really interesting visual contrast to photograph your reformed self out in front of the house where the murder happened. And he didn't say anything. And I thought, oops, maybe that's not what you're supposed to ask the guy who just got out of prison. But he thought about it a little bit and he said, that would mean a lot to me to go back to that place. And so that's where that photo was taken, down in the lower right corner. I could not have led with that, right? I could have just said, hey, Tyrone, it's really good to meet you. What do you say we go take a picture in front of the place where the murder happened? But after we'd sat for 2 hours, after we'd had a conversation, after we got to trust one another a little bit and we'd laid that foundation, there was space for that. And I'm convinced that there's nothing that we can't talk about if we approach it in a thoughtful way. You know, if I say to him at the beginning, you're totally free to say no to this, and I apologize if I'm crossing any sort of lines, but here's the thing I'm thinking, what do you think about that? You know, to craft that sort of space that empowers him to make a choice, that lets him know honestly that I'm sort of struggling with this, I'm trying to figure it out as I go, that sort of welcoming and that sort of empowering, rather than me trying to push something on him. And I think that happens with the way I do photos, it happens with the way conversations can happen as well.
What's the hardest part of your job?
It's the hardest part of my job. Time zones, I think. No, what is the hardest part of my job? The hardest part of this process for me was believing that it had worth. There's no reason I should have done this. There's certainly no reason it should have been me. I'm not an expert in much of anything, but I was interested in the conversation. You know, so at any point in the conversation, in the process, I could have just set it aside and said, okay, I better pay attention to actually doing my job. So I think that never-ending belief that this was worth seeing through, going down this path. And I think there are two reasons that could happen. One is the support of my family that made space for it. I think if I had been trying to do this and I had been in a relationship where somebody was saying, you know, you better make a little more money. You better stop doing this silly thing over here and pay attention to, you know, bringing home an income. I think it would have failed. And also I think that I consistently saw little glimmers of hope and promise in it. I consistently was fed during what could have been one of the most frustrating times in my career, as my workload was going down and down, and I surrounded myself with people who believed in positive things and people who thought they could work towards good things. That sort of environment sustained me and it became addicting. You know, I need another story like that. I need to have another conversation like that. People always ask me what my favorite interview is, and I always say the next one. You know, because I've consistently tried to invite other voices in. I finished my first book, which was all stories out of Minnesota, and people pointed out to me some of the flaws. And rightly so. Somebody who was Native American said, I don't see any Native American voices in there. And I went, shoot, you're right. a woman with a child with a disability said, I don't see anybody with a disability reflected in there. Most often it was people who didn't see themselves portrayed in the collection that said, what about me? And at that point, I needed to acknowledge the weakness. I had to grapple with my own blind spots, right? Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And then for this book, become intentional about inviting those voices in, about finding ways to let people feel included, let people feel welcomed in the process. And I think that's a never-ending process, and it happens in our life too. You know, in the first book, I got 12 stories into it, and I didn't have any Muslim voices in the project, and I recognized, given the politics of the day, that it was a really important voice, but I don't think I even knew any Muslim people then. And so then it becomes my obligation to reach out and make those connections, to see outside of my box and to find those people. And so I Googled the words Muslim, peace, and Minnesota. And it led me to this group called the Islamic Resource Group. And they're, do you know them?
Yeah.
And their goal is to try to help people understand what it is to be a Muslim in America today. Educational sessions. And I said, look, here's what I'm trying to do. I would love to include a Muslim voice. I don't have any Muslim folks in my circle. Who do you know that would be interested in being a part of this? You know, and to sort of boldly acknowledge where my weaknesses are and ask for help. And so that's been forever a part of the process. Yeah.
So I'm a new leader in my organization, and over the past few weeks, there's some parallels in my leadership training between some of the things you're saying about engagement and empowerment and inclusion and getting all the voices heard in meetings. And did you find yourself early on, like, it sounds like you're really great at interviewing, did you take classes or how did you obtain these skills to make sure that you were opening that conversation and not having closed-ended questions and making assumptions about people?
Yeah, because like anything else, that's a practice. Right? Mm-hmm. And what do you say, Joe? We do best what we do most?
Yeah.
And so I'm probably better at it now than I was when I started. My training is in journalism. I got my training as a writer. I've always worked for magazines and in sort of that journalism world and have maybe an insatiable curiosity. So it's just part of my natural process, but there are ways that it has been honed and ways, you know, you understand when you're in a conversation and you step in it, as you say, you understand, which happens all the time. And you can see it on somebody's face. You know, Fred and Judy Barron, who were Holocaust survivors, there was a moment in they were at Bergen-Belsen, Karen and I and Brenna, and Jordan have been to Dhaka. And so there was this part in the conversation where I was really, I don't want to say excited, but I wanted to connect, and this was my closest way to connect. I remember when we went to Dhaka, and it was this solemn experience, and she kind of blanched, and I'm like, and I said, what just happened? Something just shifted in the room, help me understand what happened, and she said, well, when I went back to Bergen-Belsen, I saw that they had turned it into a tourist attraction, and those people, those flowers are growing in the ashes of the people that I knew. And it's really difficult for me to see people traipsing through there, you know, taking their selfies or whatever. I had only, until that point, viewed those locations as something honoring the people who had been there through that difficulty. It had never occurred to me that she would view it as an intrusion into sacred ground. And so I needed to be sensitive to what was going on in the room. I needed to notice how the mood had shifted, and I needed to acknowledge it once it had. I couldn't feel good about moving forward until I'm like, help me understand this. And so I think that consistent process, because when we have these conversations, we are going to step in it. We're going to mess up, and hopefully if with some self-reflection, you learn how to do that better. And so, yeah, it's an ongoing process. People ask how you be a good photographer, and I say you take pictures. And the next day you take more. You want to be a good writer? Just write. You know, and pretty soon you've got more experience doing that than you had before, and you're better at it. So these conversations, I think we tend to shy away from because we're afraid of that, and then we never have the chance to get better at it. So maybe one more question, and then for crying out loud, I'm way off script. But there are some things I want to make sure to get to. Anything else before we move on? Yeah.
I just can't help visualizing you asking Martin Luther King why he was a Republican.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I just couldn't. Would that, you know, the questions you asked, I just couldn't, trying to visualize that.
That would be an interesting opportunity.
The Republicans were the first ones against the Vietnam War, which he also opposed.
Pardon?
The Republicans were the first party to come out against the Vietnam War, which King also opposed.
Well, I know.
Yeah.
So that might have been.
Yeah, well, things shift. Things change. The but I do find myself, the very first interview I did was with a woman named Barbara Nordstrom Loeb, who is a Jewish woman, and we got done, we did the portrait. I'm just about to walk out the door, and I look on top of her piano is a woven basket that looks, for all get out, like it has a swastika on it. And I'm like, whoa. I said, I gotta ask, what's up with that? I said, that's the last thing I expected to see in your home. Well, anybody's home. But she said, oh yeah, before the Nazis took that over, it was a Sanskrit thing. It was some symbol that meant beauty and wholeness.
Yeah.
And she said, I'm taking it back. You know, I'm not letting them wreck this beautiful thing for me. I'm taking it back. You know, and so there are all sorts of interesting moments for these conversations. And I mean, my first reaction was, oh my gosh. You know, but I had to ask.
The Nazis just turned it around.
Yeah, they used
to be the other way.
Yep, yeah, they spun it a little bit, made it their own, and
it went the other direction instead of the pointing the way
right.
It originally was.
Yeah, but I love that sentiment, I'm taking it back. They're not going to wreck this thing for me. I think the same thing happens with churches, right? I see these people who are acting in unchristian ways, I'm out of here. I'm leaving the church, or that's not my understanding of the beautiful faith of Christianity. I'm taking it back. Okay, so I really want to talk a little bit about this studio thing that we're going to do here, because this is a public art project that we create, and the operative word in this process is public. This depends entirely on you. I show up without a net, and I say, what do you got? And at the end of the week, we have this great body of work of people who have shared things, and it has never not worked. I'm always nervous going into it. I'm like, what if nobody shows up? What if they don't say anything interesting? It's never not worked. I think my job as a photographer is to acknowledge that there's beauty and wisdom all around us and to invite it in. And so these stories, these five-hour processes, are sort of the showcase stories for the books and the exhibits that we haul around. But we wanted to make this process more interactive. Everywhere we went, we wanted to be able to gather stories. And so this is a really different format. We craft a prompt, we craft a question based on what the community wants to talk about. Never like, what's your favorite flavor of pizza, always something that relates to the social good, about communal living and working together. We set up a studio. Look, Karen, it's you. We set up a studio. We invite people to come by. It only takes a few minutes. We ask people to share their response in 25 words or less. We do the black and white portrait, and then we combine those words and stories. So by the end of the week, we have this great body of work that talks about mission and vision and values. And I want to share some examples with you so that you can sort of see how this works. And so this is one that we recently did at a corporate diversity and inclusion conference. Their theme was bridging divides. And so we simply asked people, when have you bridged a divide? Almost always we try to phrase these questions in a way that can acknowledge success, that can use those responses as a model for how we can move forward. You know, I think it's important that we acknowledge the the problems and the flaws, but I think it's also really useful to look at when we have succeeded and use that as encouragement for doing more of it. So this is essentially what we will do with the Holden stories for the Thursday night Vespers. This is about a 5-minute video of some of the responses we got at this conference. So I'll just play this through quick.
Thank you.
Comments? Thoughts? Yeah.
To bridge a gap means to be a, make a change.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these people talked about the result rather than the cause of why they made the change. To me, I used to believe that change could only happen when you had a significant emotional experience. Like the one woman there who said she lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
In there. Or it could be a death or a serious illness or something like that. But I think we have to consciously have a significant emotional experience before we change.
You're suggesting that we can choose that.
We can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that we can make that choice.
But it takes an effort.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Momentum will keep you at the status quo.
Yes.
But it requires an intentional choice.
Absolutely.
To make that change. I like that. Thank you. Anything else? So, I want to share a couple more things. You know, we change, like I said, we change this question depending on where we go. I'm trying to remember where we asked this one. How do you want to be remembered? I think it was at Rutgers University in the leadership program. You know, I want to be remembered for embracing the unfamiliar. I want to be remembered as the person who does not back down when faced with adversity. I want to be remembered for creating a meaningful impact on at least one person's life. And I want to be remembered for lifting as I climbed. It's okay to be a little poetic in your response. You know, you've got a lot of room and you don't have to use 25 words. We try to keep it no more than 25 words just so it fits the format, just so we've got room for that. And so as we share them back, that people have time to read them as they're scrolling through. When have you found unexpected courage? That's what we asked here last year at Holden. Are you ready, Devin?
Yeah.
I share your story almost everywhere I go.
It's
Max. On the way to my surgery, I was calm and ready for my heart to be fixed. I took my older sister by the hands and told her it was going to be okay as she was sentenced to 5 years in prison. In many days, the mere act of getting up and doing life is courageous. I do life solo. I have no family. I don't do life alone, but I do life solo. We found that when you create a space to listen, that people will share amazing things. And one more. What kind of world do you want to live in? I want to live in a world that allows people to paint their self-portrait without dictating the brushstrokes. I want to live in a world where human dignity is inviolable, and to respect and protect it is the duty of all. And I want to live in a world where freedom isn't something that needs to be earned. So the question that we're asking here at Holden this week, as we talk about the unity of love, as we talk about acknowledging difference, as we talk about maybe who the Lutheran Church is, you know, and what our demographic is, as we look around the room, as we look around the country, we want to talk about privilege. We want to understand our own privilege, and I think one of the most harmful thing we can do to people when they articulate pain and frustration is to say, "Oh, you should get over that. It's probably not as bad as you think it is." I think part of our process as we come from positions of privilege is to acknowledge that, to own that, and examine what our role in that is. And so we want to ask you to think about when you've recognized your own privilege. You know, we've all had aha moments, and maybe it was last week, and maybe it was 10 years ago. Do people know the name Brian Stevenson from the Equal Justice Initiative? Yeah, I saw him talk at a Sojourner Summit for Change. And You know, he works, for those of you that don't know, he works in the world of prison reform. He works to sort of undo some unjust convictions in the prison system, primarily men of color. He's an African-American man himself, and he says, he talks about how often he goes into a courtroom and early to prep for his case, and he's sitting at the table and the judge will come in and say, "I'm sorry, sir, you're gonna have to go wait outside until your lawyer shows up." And how often he hears that and what that would mean to him. When we're at that same conference, we went around the table, and there were a lot of leaders from the Black church there, and everybody had a chance to sort of share their experience of when they had heard issues of race directed at them. And the guy sitting right next to me said, "You know, when I was in second grade, we were asked to draw a picture of what we're supposed to be, or what we wanted to be when we grew up. And so I drew a fireman. And my teacher picked it up and said, 'Oh, Danny, that's not what a garbage man looks like.'" You know, and what that sort of thing does on a repeated basis. When I had my exhibit at Pacific Lutheran University, a year and a half ago or so? Yeah. And when I was driving home, had my trailer behind me. A little trailer in Minnesota doesn't need a license plate. It just needs a little barcode sticker. Late at night, I was going, you know, just trying to make some time and get towards home. And a police officer pulled me over. Saw the lights, and I'm like, "What? I don't think I'm going too fast." And I pulled over. He didn't see a license plate, and so he's like, "I don't know how you do it in Minnesota." He, as he walked up, he saw the barcode, but he just said to me, "Let me just see the registration for the thing." He said, "I think we're good here, but let me see the registration." And I leaned over and I flipped over, opened the glove box, and I ruffled through it, and I found it, and I handed it to him. And then I thought, if I was a young Black man, and I would have reached over and open that glove box on the side of the road in the middle of the night, that could have gone really different. And I think for me, the fact that I didn't even have to think about it, that all I did, I'm like, "Oh yeah, let me grab it." And I did all of the things that seem threatening if you're a young Black man. The fact that I didn't have to think about it is that privilege. You know, so what I would invite you to do is to think about when that's happened in your life, moments when you had awareness that maybe my experience is profoundly different than somebody else's. Maybe there are things I don't have to think about that are right in front of somebody every day of their experience. We've got a couple of minutes. Does anybody have something that comes to mind that you want to share?
I remember a friend asked on like social media, like, "Dear white friends, if you're not talking to your kids about race, start now." And I had like a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old at the time, and I realized we had talked about like certain things, but like we didn't have a regular conversation about race in our family, and so we started to.
Yeah, I think it's easy for us to not, right? It's not my problem. I get a pass. But I think it is our obligation if something's going to shift.
Well, it was my own acknowledgement that I didn't, wasn't even claiming my own race. Like, that, you know, and so it's an ongoing journey, and having it with my own parents who, you know, look at it from a different perspective of, well, if we, the reason we don't talk about it is because then we acknowledge we're all equal and have, like, the listening and know that's how I was raised, and yet like how important it is to acknowledge who we really are and what that means and how we get to know each other and can recognize our own identity in order to get to know people who are different than us and really be able to see each other completely.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
When I was a kid growing up, my family was confronted with this a little bit. There was an African-American gentleman that came to work for the city of Everett, where my dad worked, and there was a hesitation on the part of the office, the folks that worked in my dad's office, as to where his desk would be placed. And my dad stood up and said, "Please put," can't say this without tearing up. Please put his desk next to mine. Mm-hmm. I would be honored to have Mr. Meeks sit next to me. And I've always been so proud of my dad. Because that was a long, long time ago. Probably, it was probably in the 60s.
In a time when that might have been more difficult for him to do.
Right.
But that small gesture of welcome.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got one. You know, I've never shared this even outside my own family, so I'm kind of surprised that I'm not ready to say this, but probably the thing that's most profound in my life in the context of what we're talking about now is that, it was just a couple of years ago, our youngest daughter came home and told us that she was gay. And I didn't know that. And that's kind of embarrassing when that happens, that something that fundamental, you don't know. The thing that I thought about many times since that moment, by the way, she's getting married in September to a wonderful woman.
Awesome.
And I'm so excited for her and where they're going in life. But I'm realizing that simple things, just like when you reached over to the glove compartment, I never had to think about these things. I could hold my wife's hand in public. What I did, what my journey, most of it, I did under the rules that were there, you know. They required no bravery, no courage, nothing. I just simply existed in a very comfortable place. So my privilege is that was all there for me. And my hope for my daughter moving forward is that she can have that too. And I think she can. It's a different world today than it was when I was her age. It's remarkable in my eyes the sea change that I see that has existed and has come forth. But that's my privilege and my hope. It's not for myself, it's for my daughter and the future and all those people that can live in a world as comfortable and as privileged as I've had, maybe. I don't know. That's just a thought. And I've never, like I said, I've never really, to your credit, John, I've never even, I haven't had this conversation. So there you go.
Thanks, Ben.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, if you could just boil that down to 25 words, we'd go see that.
Yeah.
Did you have something you wanted to add, and then we should close?
Yeah. I think to follow that. It's very similar, though, also boiling it down to 25 words. But growing up, I was raised in small town, Midwest town, and there was one black family. I had all the opportunities in front of me. I got, great education. I went to public school. I, ended up getting a full ride scholarship because I had such great grades to go to undergrad. And then same thing, I went on to pharmacy school. And through this whole path, I thought everyone had that same opportunity. Mm-hmm. I can even remember having an argument. We ended up living in Cleveland for 4 years after pharmacy school. And that was eye-opening to just open us to cultural diversity and having a conversation with someone and just trying to understand how they didn't have the same opportunities that I did. I couldn't comprehend it. You have public school? How is your public school in downtown Cleveland or downtown Chicago different than my public school experience? Like, how can you not get good grades and go to college and be all the things you want to be? Because there's some point in my mid-20s where I realized I was privileged. Like, I was lucky to be born into what I was born into. And people don't have the same opportunities that I do, and how can we help people have those opportunities and to achieve all their dreams and be whatever they want to be when they grow up, because they don't have the same environment.
Yeah, thank you. I think if you were to create a poster child of privilege, it could be me. I mean, maybe your poster child would be a little more trim and have a little less gray hair. But I mean, married, cisgendered, white, male, college educated, you know, fill in, check the boxes. Yeah. So the question is, what are you going to do with that? What are we called to do with that? I want to give you just a little tiny view of what we're going to do the rest of the week. So we actually have these forms here. The process is really simple. I know last year they had a sign-up sheet up at the ARC. You don't need a sign-up sheet, just show up. You know, if you're willing to sit for a few minutes while we work our way through a couple people who might be there, just show up and we'll fit you in. You can take a sheet with you now if you want and think about how you want to answer that. You can scribble on the back as your rough draft. You can come to me with a 75 word response and I can help you trim it down to 25. If you just don't know how you want to answer it, we can sit there and talk for a couple of minutes and figure it out. But in the end, we'll ask for your response up here. Fill out the rest of this that says you're willing for your voice to be a part of this larger ARC project. Our goal is to share these stories widely and use this collective wisdom to encourage people towards change. If you really just want to do it for the Holden community, we can cross stuff off and we'll just do it for the Holden community. If I have your email and if I can read it, at the end of this, I'll email you like next week when I get home and have useful Wi-Fi. I'll email you a link to the gallery where you can download your image. You're free to use that however you like. The finished piece with the words, and we see them pop up on social media, and it all helps ripple out positive and encouraging conversation to, you know, make sure that people are thinking about this stuff. So I'm going to be at the studio right after lunch from 1 o'clock till 2:30, right over in the VC. I'm going to be there with the studio tomorrow from 10 in the morning till 1:30. And then we have to quit because then I have to do all the production and get it ready for sharing at Vespers on Thursday night. Tomorrow's conversation, late in the afternoon, I forget the time exactly, but a month ago I went down to Texas to do an interview on Texas death row. And I'll be sharing some of that, talking more about sort of some of these stories out of prison. Also talked with a woman who used to work for the state and witnessed 300 executions in her time there and what that has meant for her. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then on Thursday, again, sort of in this morning slot, I just got back from Kenya and was working with a bunch of folks there around the idea of doing good, what inspires you to do good and create change, and I'll be sharing a lot of that. I don't exactly know how that's going to go, but I got some time between now and then. Yes?
It's
1:30 to 3. Thank you. All right, so thank you very much. I hope we see you again.